WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ted Levin, spent 4 years in the 90s traveling through Central Asia, studying and recording indigenous musics. He's particularly interested in how music connects to the inner lives of the performers and to the cultural and spiritual traditions the Soviet Union had tried to eradicate. His new book, The 100,000 Fools of God, is about his musical travels in Central Asia and in Queens, New York, where many Bukharan emigres now live. Levin's recordings of music from Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Tuva, Georgia, and Bosnia have been released by Nonesuch Records and Smithsonian Folkways. His new book has a companion CD included with the book of music he recorded in Central Asia. This is music by an Uzbek singer. He's part of the tradition of Turkic bards who accompany themselves on stringed instruments. So how do you see your mission in Central Asia musically?
I'm trying to let those musicians tell their own story about their music. That's a story that has never been told until now. It's funny that we think of music as being something separate from language and not necessarily being narrative. And one of the implications of that is that people make up their own stories about music. It's mutable. It's protean. You can make up all sorts of different kinds of stories about what some piece of music is or means. And that makes it really a plum target for cultural strategists who can manipulate it. And that's what happened during the Soviet years. The story was told in a different way. So what I'm trying to do and what I've tried to do in this book is to let these musicians tell the story of what they do in more or less their own words. Of course, I'm the storyteller. I'm quoting from them, but the words are theirs.
Now, on your CD that comes with the book, my favorite track is by a singer from Bukhara who recently moved to Queens, New York. And in fact, you've just released an entire CD by him on the Shanaki label. Before we hear some of his singing, would you describe the kind of singing that he's doing?
This is classical music from Central Asia. It's a genre of music that's analogous, say, to the great classical music of Europe, and its complexity, the length of the pieces, kinds of complex musical forms and structures that they use. And this is a tradition that has developed not only in Central Asia but in other parts of the Islamic world over something approaching 1,000 years. And Ilyas Malayev is a virtuoso in this tradition. He's a virtuoso singer and he's a virtuoso instrumentalist. And he knows a great deal of this repertory by memory. And he's also adding to it. He's not simply a passive performer, but he's a creator. He's actively writing music, writing new texts and new melodies and adding to the repertory.
I want to play some of the song that he does on the companion CD to your new book. Tell us something about this song.
This is from the Shash Makam, which is the great cycle. It's a series of six suites put together in a cycle, and the pieces are sung. It moves in a kind of progression that Ilias describes as being from prayer to dance and covering the full range of human emotions, of human sentiments. So in the beginning, you hear the music. It's slow. It's ponderous. It's deep. It's contemplative. And little by little, it goes over a long period of time. To listen to one of these cycles in its entirety might take you 5 or 6 hours. And that's what people used to do. They'd sit for an evening and they'd listen to this. At the end, it's something approaching a kind of ecstasy, dance-like, almost bacchanalian. But it all has this relationship to a kind of spiritual devotion.
Okay, and this is from the companion CD to Ted Levin's book, The 100,000 Fools of God. You know, when I first listened to this song, I assumed that this singer was Muslim and that this song was part of Islamic tradition. The singer is, in fact, Jewish and from Bukhara. I guess there's a lot of connections between Jewish and Islamic singing styles in Central Asia.
There are indeed. There's been Jewish communities in Central Asia, particularly in Bukhara and in Samarkand, and these days also in Tashkent. Those communities have been there for at least 1,000 years. And Jews in Central Asia, in Bukhara, for instance, under the Bukharan Emirate, fulfilled social roles that were considered undesirable for Muslims. And one of those roles was the role of musician. Music has what you might say is a morally ambiguous role in Islamic societies because of its ability to affect people deeply in a moral way, either for good or for worse. So Jews became the court musicians to the Muslim emirs of Bukhara. And in fact, one of the musicians I recorded is the grandson of a man who was one of these court musicians to the last emir of Bukhara.
That is just so interesting. It's kind of like the musicians were the equivalent of the Shabbos goy, the Gentile who would turn on the lights at the temple on the Sabbath because Jewish people weren't supposed to turn on the lights.
Yeah, that's what they were. That's exactly right. And then it wasn't limited to Bukhara. These Jews were formed musical communities in other Islamic cities.
Now, the singer who we just heard, who's now living in Queens, what's really interesting about him, too, is that you say he was the equivalent, the closest that Uzbekistan got to a vaudeville star while he was living there. And he used to play to stadiums of like 25,000 people. But in addition to doing these like pop tunes and you know, little comic sketches, he does this ancient music.
Well, I think that's partly how it got preserved, because by not doing it as his vocation, but as his avocation, he didn't come under the pressures that so-called professional performers of this music came under to alter it in ways that were compatible with Soviet ideas about cultural politics. In other words, this music, this Shash Makam music, like other repertories in the Soviet Union, it became a kind of tool of the state. and of state culture policy, so that it became a symbol for the national identity of Uzbeks in Uzbekistan and Tajiks in Tajikistan. And this was very ironic because the tradition had been for centuries a unified tradition of Uzbeks and Tajiks, and there had been texts in Turkic language, Uzbek, and in Tajik, which is Iranian. And performers did them in either language depending on whom their audience was. The area is really quite bilingual. But under Soviet culture policy, it was split into two separate repertories, one for Uzbeks and one for Tajiks, and both became symbols of national identity of these Soviet republics. And they also adapted the style of European music. There was an idea that Lenin had originally that in order for these Asian republics to advance culturally and socially, they had to adopt the cultural models of Europe. And that meant orchestras and ensembles and mass choirs. And that's what they did to this music. And it was a tragedy because it was never meant to be performed by these orchestras, these folk orchestras. And what Ilyas did by not having to do that for a profession, by being a vaudeville performer, was that in the privacy of his own home and his own friends, he kept it alive in a more traditional form. And that's what reemerged when he moved to Queens and what I recorded.
Now, do you have any examples on your CD of a European-type choir singing what had been traditional music?
Yes. We have, in fact, an excerpt of this same Shash Makam repertory that's recorded by the Makam Ensemble at Uzbekistan Radio, the way it's being performed now in Uzbekistan.
And so do you consider this like the official culture version of the music?
Yes, yes.
Let's hear some of that. The Makam Ensemble of Uzbekistan Radio, as featured on the companion disc to my guest Ted Levin's new book, The 100,000 Fools of God, Musical Travels in Central Asia. Ted, you know, I realize this is a kind of phony music in some ways, a state-orchestrated music. It's interesting, nevertheless. I still kind of like it.
Well, it's done with great sincerity. This is the thing that one, and I was prepared to dislike the man who was the leader of that group. I never met him. I'd heard about him. And when I went to record him and talk to him, I realized that he was extremely sincere about what he was doing. But nonetheless, it seemed to be going down a wrong track.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, it's so interesting the different reasons why this music was condemned over the years. You know, early on, in many places, Muslims couldn't sing it because of the more like sensual or licential aspects of music and what music can evoke. And then, you know, the Soviet Union tried to change it or eradicate it or Europeanize it. And now a lot of Bukharan Jews are living in New York City. And you say that in New York City, some of the Orthodox rabbis don't like this music either, and they're discouraging the singing of this music. For what reason?
Well, they're running up against some of the same issues that come up in Islam, that traditionally in Judaism, you don't have instruments in the synagogue. You know, the use of organs, for instance, in Reform synagogues, that's an innovation. That's something you don't find in Orthodox Judaism. There's a lot of canons about the use of music, about what sort of music is used, when it's used, and the Bukharans, having been off by themselves for sort of 1,200 years in Central Asia and having been very much integrated into a local Muslim cultural establishment, adopted a lot of the Islamic practices about music, or sort of merged them with their own. And so now, coming back into a Jewish community in New York that's really dominated by Jewish emigres from Eastern Europe, they find themselves at odds with the religious establishment over some of these issues, and it's created some bad feelings among some of the Bukharans.
My guest is musicologist Ted Levin. His new book is called The 100,000 Fools of God, Musical Travels in Central Asia. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ted Levin, and he spent several years traveling through Central Asia, studying the music there, recording it, collecting it. His new book is called The 100,000 Fools of God, Musical Travels in Central Asia and Queens, New York. I'll tell you something that really fascinated me. Ilyas Malayev, the solo singer who we heard a couple of minutes ago, is now living in Queens, and a place he ends up singing a lot is at the weddings of friends. And a lot of these weddings in Queens, weddings of Bukharan Jews from Central Asia, are being held at Leonard's, which is, it's like the Palace of Catered Affairs in Long Island, New York. When I was growing up, I don't know, what do they have, like 5 or 10 catered affairs at a time in this place? And there's just like hundreds of people going to these different affairs. And it was we used to think of it as a kitsch palace. And to think now that this is the scene for a lot of emigre Jews, and it's one of the places where this traditional music is occasionally sung, it's just kind of mind-boggling to me.
Well, Leonard's is really quite an experience. The day I was there, the last time with Ilyas, there was a Bukharan Jewish wedding going on the bottom floor, where there were around 700 people, and there was a Korean wedding going on the top floor. And I sort of floated back a little between the two weddings, and remarkably, they were really quite similar in style. And even the music seemed a little bit similar, the sort of genre of kind of tradition-based pop, with the accent on the pop.
Right. One of the tracks on the companion CD to your new book is music from a healing ceremony called a Akach that you recorded in Central Asia. And maybe you could describe a little bit what this ceremony is like and where the music fits in.
We recorded this ceremony in a little town in the north of Tajikistan that strangely has a large concentration of traditional healers. We call them shamans here, but in Central Asia they're called bakhshis. They're I suppose you could think of them as shamans, and they use sound as a way to heal. They're largely women. And the woman that we recorded played a drum and went into a kind of trance and chanted. And what was interesting about her chanting was that the text combined elements of animistic pre-Islamic belief, in other words, belief in the power of spirits, with Islam. And so you see the different layers of history that are being melded together in this ritual that shamanism, of course, is completely un-Islamic, opposed to the idea of Islam. And yet, in this melting pot of cultures, everything has come together and everything finds a way to coexist. They're very practical people, and they're driven not so much by ideological zeal, but by the need to find practical solutions to practical problems.
Tell us something about the singer healer that we're going to hear.
She was a lovely woman, Nasri Oy, around 60 years old. And like many shamans, she'd come to her profession through a profound sickness and then a revelation that this was something that she had to do. She'd had been married to a man who'd deserted her and left her with a couple of kids, and she'd moved around and lived in one place and another. And finally, in quite late in life, she'd come to this realization that she had to be a shaman. And she started practicing, and she seemed to be very content with her life. She lived very modestly in this town, out on the edge of town. And she was a wonderfully friendly and strong and outgoing woman. And we've been back there a number of times to see her.
Well, let's hear her. This is Nasri Oy singing as part of a healing ceremony in Central Asia. Ted, when you were there recording this music, did it appear to you like the singer Nasri Oy was entering an altered state through this singing and healing ritual?
Well, only she could tell, of course, but yes, my perception was that she rather quickly was able to put herself into some kind of different state in which she could contact the spirits.
Ted Levin is the author of the new book, The 100,000 Fools of God, Musical Travels in Central Asia. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with musicologist Ted Levin. His new book, The 100,000 Fools of God, is based on his experiences traveling through Central Asia. It comes with a companion CD of field recordings he made along the way. Ted, what does the Central Asian music do for you musically? What do you hear in it that you don't get from, say, pop or classical music or jazz?
To me, this music presents a relationship with something that's very, very old. There's a continuous tradition of music there that's gone back to ancient times. It's gone through all sorts of transformations and changes, as any music does over time. But it's this link to something ancient that first attracted me. And that's really the reason for the title of my book, this notion of the fools of God. What is a fool of God? Well, fools of God are people who view music as a moral calling and assume the responsibility, the moral responsibility for guiding a community through music. And this is an idea that really came out of the ancient world. If you read Plato, if you read Aristotle, you can read about the ethical power that the ancients saw or felt in music that could guide people toward the good or toward the bad or towards violence, towards, as Plato wrote in the Republic, towards being a warrior or towards being complacent. So music had this power, and musicians, the purveyors of this power, had a very special position in society. And what I found in Central Asia was that ancient tradition is still alive. People knew about these traditions, and aside from living in the pages of books, they also lived in those cultures. The idea of the musician as a special person, a moral person, a moral leader, is something that you still see there. And that's really very different from our society, where I think we in our society perhaps look for just the opposite in musicians. We want people who transgress, people who do the outrageous, the unusual. But it's that attraction to this link to something ancient that first attracted me to this.
How did you first go to Central Asia?
My first trip was way back in 1974. I'd just graduated from Amherst College and gotten a Thomas Watson traveling fellowship. And with that money, it was just a bunch of money. You could do anything you wanted as long as you left the United States for a year and didn't work and didn't go to school. And I took the money and I traveled really on a sort of lark to Central Asia. I'd gotten interested in Islam actually during a trip to Israel. I'd gone to Israel to try to rediscover my Jewish roots, but instead of Judaism, I discovered Islam. And after that, I went to Afghanistan, and I liked it. I can't explain it. I liked the music. I liked the people. I liked the food. I liked the landscape. I went back there in graduate school at Princeton to work on a dissertation on this classical music, the Shashmaqam. And then after that, I dropped out of academe, actually, for about 5 years and worked in the Soviet Union in the early years of Glasnost, organizing cultural exchanges and at the same time continuing my musical interests. I got National Geographic to back a couple of expeditions, and I went around Uzbekistan and using my old contacts, I started recording both music and recording the stories that these musicians told about their lives.
Now, you've not only studied and recorded music of Central Asia, you've done some singing yourself that relates to this music. You were in a group several years ago called the Harmonic Choir that used the kind of harmonic overtone singing that some Zen monks use for meditation. And let me ask you to describe the singing.
Well, this is a tradition of singing that comes out of South Siberia. It's a somewhat different part of Inner Asia than Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, the subject of the book. But this singing is something that exists in different forms throughout large parts of Turkic Inner Asia. It's most highly developed in Tuva, which has become a kind of a cult interest among some Americans now. The singing is done by selectively articulating harmonics, which are naturally present in the voice, so that you can sing two or three notes at the same time, a fundamental pitch and an articulated harmonic. And it's, yes, indeed, Tibetan Buddhist monks who have also adopted this technique for liturgical purposes.
Could you just do a little bit of this to demonstrate what you mean?
Well, I'm by no means a virtuoso at this, but I'll give you a little shot of it just to give the sense of the harmonics.
Yeah, you hear several different overtones there, several different notes as you're singing. It's very shimmering.
But that's really a pale imitation of what the Tuvan throat singers do.
How did you learn to do it?
Well, it was in the harmonic choir. This group was started by a musician named David Hikes, who was in New York in the late 70s and early 80s. And he taught himself by listening to a recording made in Outer Mongolia. And I joined the group, and he insisted that all of us teach ourselves to do it just as he had. So it's a sort of trial and error thing. I don't think it's really possible to teach people. The Tuvans, for instance, say that they're not really taught. They simply learn. It's sort of like learning language. You just listen and you imitate.
My guest is musicologist Ted Levin. His new book is called The 100,000 Fools of God, Musical Travels in Central Asia. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is musicologist Ted Levin. Well, you have produced records by and led tours by a Tuvan singing group called Hunhurtu. And this group sings both in the harmonic throat singing style that you've just demonstrated, and they also sing in a more melodic form of music as well. How did you come across the singing?
I went to Tuva in 1987. I'd been interested in the singing because of my work in the harmonic choir and had very much wanted to meet the people who did it. I had no sense, really, of who they were or what they'd be like or what it meant for them, the music that we'd heard that had been recorded and sort of passed on to us. Of course, we heard it completely out of cultural context, and we, in a sense, made up our own story about it. And I think that's what a lot of Americans are doing now, is they hear this music in the tour around the country that, that the group Hunhertu is doing. It's a music that, in a sense, lends itself to making up your own story about. But what I wanted to do was go there and find out the story that the Tuvans told about it.
I want to hear some of that story. But first, let's listen to a selection from a new CD that you've produced of Hunhertu's music. The CD is called If I'd Been Born an Eagle. And the track I'd like to play actually features a solo singer kind of imitating the sounds of an eagle. And this is in that, that throat singing style that you demonstrated before with all the overtones in it. Would you like to say something about this track before we hear it?
This is Chilindik. The Chilindik is a bird that sings only late at night. We went out at around 11 o'clock in the evening, which is when the Chilindik supposedly sings. Our idea was to record the Chilindik itself, and then the musical imitation of the Chilindik. Turned out that we were there at the wrong time of year. The Chilindik only sings in May and June, and we were there in August. So we never got the Chilindik itself, but Kaigalo Hovelig, one of the members of the group, did record the imitation of this sound.
Well, let's hear it. That's really incredible singing, and the music that we heard is from the CD Hunhertu, If I'd Been Born an Eagle, produced by my guest, Ted Levin. You said you wanted to find out what stories the Tuvans tell about their own music, and maybe you could tell us one of the stories that you found that helps explain the development of this style of singing.
For the Tuvans, the music is really rooted in their tradition of animism. Again, like the shamans, the belief in spirits and the idea that the natural world is inhabited by spirits, and that humankind can people can emplace themselves in these spirits and in the natural places inhabited by spirits by making music. So in this sense, music has a concrete spiritual reality for them. And it's based really in a what you might call a cult of imitation, which is part of this animist tradition. That is, the way you emplace yourself in some part of nature is by imitating the sounds of that place, or by trying to describe or narrate what that place looks like. So in some cases, what you're doing is converting a visual image of a landscape into a song, while in other cases, what you're doing is imitating either directly or in a kind of musical fantasy some kind of sound from nature, bird, wind, water. And in fact, a lot of these songs narrate stories. They actually tell stories, not with texts, but with melody. And someone from this culture who's familiar with the tradition can hear, for instance, a melody being played on one of the bowed fiddles. And people will weep at appropriate moments in the story. It's sort of like program music. It's a music that's deeply filled with emotion that people react to without any text.
Now, the singer who we just heard, is he part of a tradition and where this singing has been going on for years, or is he more of a revivalist who wasn't wasn't born into this kind of singing but rediscovered it and is trying to revive it?
He's both. He comes from a family of singers. His grandfather was a well-known singer, but his grandfather sang in an utterly different way than he does. That is, this group, Hunhertu, which is touring around the States now, has arranged the music in a way that makes it accessible to audiences in the West. This group has no connection with the government. It's simply four guys who went out on their own and started arranging this music. And I think they've done a marvelous job of it.
Are you watching them get changed by their exposure to the United States and other Western countries?
Yes, it's inevitable. They've been on the road 4 years now. They're touring intensively, not only in the States, but in Europe. I've taken them to the Far East. Their musical interests are eclectic. When we go into a record store to do these in-store record appearances, they'll come out with the Ray Charles record, and that's what we listen to in the van as we're driving around. They're very fond of Ray Charles.
Who wouldn't be?
Yeah, sure. These influences find their way into their music. But I very much admire their self-restraint and the dedication that they have to their own tradition. They've been sort of through the whole rock and roll and pop scene. A couple of the guys have played, are veterans of some of these Soviet-era bands, the big dance and song shows, jazz and rock bands, and they've come out the other side of that. And what we're doing now is a kind of musical archaeology. We're trying to recover the roots of this music, both through field work, through talking to old people and trying to jog the memories, and through intuition, through thinking about it and putting things together. For instance, one of the things we've done, and we're showing this on the tour, there's a style of this throat singing that imitates something rolling. The name of the style, Barbangadir, means in Tuvan, rolling. And the idea is to imitate something in nature that's rolling. And one day I asked Tolya Kular, who's the specialist in this style, well, what do you imitate? What's rolling? And he said, well, for instance, water in a stream. And I suggested, well, let's try it. Rather than simply singing it on the stage, let's go find a stream and get in the stream and sing to the water and see what happens. And we did that. And to our great surprise, there was something very interesting that happened, which was that the overtones in the singing fused or melded with the overtones in the rushing water. That water, when it's moving, sends up a shower of overtones. Which is sometimes if you're in the shower and you think you're hearing the phone ringing, mm-hmm. That's why it's the overtones being sent out by the dripping water in a resonant tub. Anyway, this experiment turned out to really set a direction for us of trying to put the music back into the natural acoustic landscapes in which it had originally been sung. So we're making recordings now of singing to water, or of using cliffs to resonate the kind of singing that's called long songs in Tuvan, Uzunirya. These are songs that are long, not by virtue of having many verses, but long in reverberation. And traditionally, singers would find a cliff, and they'd go to the cliff, and they'd just sing against the cliff and enjoy that reverb. Or they use wind. Or they use caves. We went and made recordings in a cave last summer because there's a lot of legends in Tuva about the power, the spiritual power of caves. So we're in this together, and it's wonderful to work with them. We're trying to let this music, in a sense, tell its own story. And what's interesting is that Americans have made up their own stories about the music, too. And they're really charming stories in many cases. A lot of them have to do with the power of the music to heal. There's a lot of people in the States. There's a whole subculture that practices harmonic singing or overtone singing as a kind of healing. And after the concerts, people come back and they want to sing for the Tuvans and show them how the overtones can be used to heal. And the Tuvans are very polite, but they're also very honest, and they say, thank you very much. I'm glad this music uh, heals you, but frankly, it doesn't touch us. We prefer to sing overtones our own way.
Well, Ted Levin, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your stories and your music with us. Really appreciate it. And Ted Levin's new book is called The 100,000 Fools of God, Musical Travels in Central Asia and Queens, New York, and it comes with a companion CD. And Ted, why don't we close with another song from Hun Hortu, from the new album that you produced, If I'd Been Born an Eagle. And this is an interesting contrast to the singing we heard before. It's the same singer, but this is a much more melodic approach to singing. Just say something brief about it before we hear it.
Taran Taram is one of my favorite songs on the album. I'm delighted that you like it too. I just like to read the words because the song is so evocative of this text that we translated from Tuvan. The grain that I sowed in the level field, is it waving? My beloved one so far away, is she thinking of me? Forage grain is on the blue field, is it waving? Gazing into the distance, how deeply does she remember me? When you look, it seems like just a blue cliff, but in fact it's a land where you can plant wheat. It seems to you as if she's lonely, but in fact she has a friend whom she likes to talk to. What they do in this text is to present an image of the outer world, of nature, grain in a field, and then by analogy to compare that to a kind of snapshot of the inner world, the world of emotions and sentiments. My beloved one so far away, is she thinking of me? And that's what all of these songs do in different ways. They create analogies between the outer world and the inner world. And that's how, for the Tuvans, they both bring their natural world into themselves, into their hearts, and bring themselves into nature.
Ted, thanks again. And here's Hun Hortu. Music by the Tuvan singing group Hun Hortu. The CD is called If I'd Been Born an Eagle. It's on Shanaki Records.